Hello, welcome to our program on careers. I'm Irene Lubin, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I would like to begin today's program with an article which appeared in the New York Times on the 29th of March. This article was written for the Times by Noam Scheiber. Noam Scheiber covers white-collar workers. This article has been adapted from his forthcoming book, Mutiny, The Rise and Revolt of the College-Educated Working Class. The title of this article is Why College Graduates Feel Betrayed. Political observers on the left and the right had very different views on whether or not Zoran Mamdani would be a good mayor for New York City. But one thing they did agree upon was why so many young college graduates supported the self-proclaimed democratic socialist. As Peter Thiel, the venture capitalist and Trump backer, put it in an interview with the Free Press after last fall's election, too many people today graduate from college with useless degrees, sky-high debt, and long odds of owning a home. The graduates saw Mamdani as a solution to these problems. If you proletarianize the young people, Mr. Thiel said, you should not be surprised if they eventually become communists. He's not wrong, at least about the economic challenges facing recent college graduates. Student debt has escalated over the past few decades, while housing is increasingly inaccessible for young Americans, especially in high-priced areas such as New York and San Francisco. Perhaps most alarmingly, recent college graduates are having a harder time finding work. Between 1990 and 2018, it was almost unheard of for the unemployment rate of recent college graduates to exceed the country's overall rate. But that has been the case for five straight years now. It appears that the white-collar job market is going to continue to soften this year, and almost all of these problems precede the impact of artificial intelligence, which is still in the early stages of cannibalizing human labor. As a result, poll after poll show that college graduates are unusually dour. In surveys by the University of Michigan dating back to the 1960s, the college-educated had never been more downbeat about economic conditions than over the past 4 years. Gallup recently found that the portion of college graduates who thought it was a good time to find a quality job was a mere 19%, down from over 70% in 2022. Of course, the economic turmoil of the last decade or two has taken a toll on millions of Americans. Most of them lacked degrees, and many fared even worse financially than the college-educated. But for young college graduates, extended bouts of unemployment or long periods stuck in a low-paying job that did not make use of their degrees upended the entire picture of adulthood they had been taught to expect. In effect, a gap has opened up between the life that many graduates believed they had been promised and their actual prospects, and they're seething about it. For people in their 20s and early 30s, those expectations were forged as early as elementary school, when college for all became a national obsession, the way every American could achieve middle-class affluence. One of the country's largest charter school networks, KIPP, helped popularize the mantra, "College starts in kindergarten," after it was founded in 1994, not long before this cohort was in fact entering kindergarten. Presidents reminded families that the return on a college investment was nearly double that of the stock market, as according to Bill Clinton, and that college was no longer a luxury, but an economic imperative, according to Barack Obama. With an eye toward future college enrollment, students slogged through longer school days and labored over more homework. One scholar found that the average amount of time that younger children in elementary school spent studying at home increased roughly threefold between 1981 and 2003. In high school, when it was time for actual college prep, as opposed to just the preparation for the prep, they stuffed their resumes full of university-level classes. The number of students taking advanced placement, or AP, courses grew tenfold from the 1980s to the early 2010s, as the author Malcolm Harris has noted. At Adena High School, in an upper middle class suburb of Minneapolis, the now 34-year-old Teddy Hoffman took more than half a dozen AP classes before being admitted to Grinnell College in Iowa. It was a fairly common course load for someone who aspired to attend a competitive college such as Grinnell. And it wasn't just affluent white students who became foot soldiers in the college admissions arm race. At the Baltimore County High School that Kaya Barrett, now 32, attended, students were tracked into classes where they studied vocabulary words and took practice SATs so that no matter of test question would faze them. It was, "We want you to get into college," said Ms. Barrett, who later graduated from Towson University in Maryland. "We're a mostly black school, and we have high school acceptance rates, and we want to keep that up." In this relentless race to the college quad, money was no object. Dylan Burton, who uses gender-neutral pronouns, already had a lot of college credit when they enrolled in the video game design program at the University of Texas in Dallas in 2017. It would still cost them nearly $70,000 over 2.5 years to earn their bachelor's degree after room and board. But they had wanted to make video games since childhood, and the industry was exploding in popularity and in revenue. So millions of people, such as Mr. Hoffman and Ms. Barrett and MX Burton, applied for scholarships and part-time jobs and took out loans to cover the difference. MX Burton borrowed the full amount. For several years, these students juggled finals and term papers and the night shift at the dining hall or the weekend shift at the mall. And then, once they graduated, many found themselves with tens of thousands of dollars in loans and no path to a job in line with their credentials. So, the baristas with degrees. While this generation was focused on earning degrees, the job market was worsening, slowly at first, and then all at once. According to a paper by the Berkeley economist Jesse Rothstein, recent graduates started doing significantly worse than older graduates around the year 2005, and then fell much further behind during the Great Recession. The employment rate for recent graduates had yet to fully recover by the COVID-19 pandemic, which struck a little bit later, which upended the job market all over again. At the highest altitude, the problem was that the economy was producing more graduates, but not as many of the jobs they traditionally held. Some economists argue that software had begun already to eliminate jobs in fields such as financial services and merchandise planning well before the rise of generative artificial intelligence. On the average, college graduates still earned a large premium over people with only a high school diploma. But the averages concealed the fact that some graduates were doing very well, such as people who worked on Wall Street and in big tech, while others were falling behind. For decades, many young graduates had earned good money even if their jobs did not require a degree, according to researchers at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. But many of those roles, such as insurance agent and human resource workers, appeared to start paying less or disappearing altogether in the 2000s and never recovered. A larger portion of these overqualified graduates ended up in jobs that did not pay well. After earning his degree from Grinnell in 2014 and spending a year abroad on a prestigious Watson Fellowship, Mr. Hoffman became a barista at Starbucks. The idea was to buy time while he settled on a career path. He had studied English and theater. But 7 years later, he was still at Starbucks, partly because the pandemic had delayed his professional plans. With a child on the way and money getting tight, he and his wife applied for temporary public assistance. The state rejected their application. McBurton, who in college had led a team that made a playable video game called Kai Jr., K-A-I-J-R, struggled to find work as a designer after graduating in 2019. It turned out that designing video games, notwithstanding the university's optimistic marketing material, was more akin to becoming a Hollywood actor than a computer programmer. The field could support only a small fraction of the millions of people eager to enter it. McBurton eventually took a much more tedious job testing video games for glitches for $15 an hour. "My student loans were about to kick in and I didn't have a job yet," McBurton said. "You have to not be picky anymore." So, as Ms. Barrett prepared to graduate with a degree in communications from Towson in 2018, she applied for dozens of jobs in fields such as marketing and professional training at the likes of Accenture, Amazon, and Stanley Black & Decker. After getting no bites and with roughly $50,000 in debt, she went full-time at the Apple Store where she had worked in college. The store often seduced college graduates with job titles like genius and expert, along with its generous benefits, but Ms. Barrett had still hoped for more. Class confidence. In his 2000 book, Bobos in Paradise, David Brooks identified a new upper class of bourgeois bohemians, a demographic of techies, financiers, and tenured professors who had the earning power and ideology of the bourgeois, but the tastes and habits of bohemians. They favored balanced budgets and free trade. They went on expensive ski vacations, and they kept second homes. But they decorated them with reclaimed wood furniture and grew heirloom produce in the backyard. By the early 2020s, young college-educated adults were in some sense the mirror image of Mr. Brooks' Bobos. They were often bourgeois in their tastes. They cradled sleek smartphones and watched prestige TV on demand. But the previous decade and a half had bequeathed them the bank accounts and the politics of the proletariat. Polling by the Pew Research Center showed that the portion of college graduates with positive views of socialism roughly doubled during the 2010s to over 40%. The shift helped to fuel the rise of politicians such as Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, left-wing figures who built mass appeal. The ideology of these disaffected college graduates did not end with economics. At the most fundamental level, their politics elevated the underdog. They were more likely than non-graduates to call out the harassers of women and gay and transgender people. They worried about racism and they worried about climate change. They were growing skeptical of law enforcement and they believed the Iraq War had been a mistake. Perhaps the most visible expression of this ideology came at work, where many college graduates increasingly saw themselves as the underdog. They began to unionize at previously non-union workplaces, such as video game studios, architecture firms, and banks. In the year 2023, hundreds of doctors in Minnesota and Wisconsin, fed up with mergers and acquisitions that had made them feel like cogs in the medical industrial complex, formed what was the largest union of private sector physicians in the country. And it was the college graduates stuck in jobs that did not require a degree who seemed most determined to take on their employers. College had taught them to question. It had instilled in them what the sociologist Ruth Milkman called class confidence, a sense of agency that comes from knowing how to work the system, a broader perspective than the day-to-day grind. But at the cash register with the manager looking on, they had to smile and take whatever the customer gave them. I have been pretty hard on myself, thinking the exhaustion was just me having an attitude problem, Mr. Hoffman wrote to a friend during his second year at Starbucks. But there are just too many human interactions in which you aren't recognized as a human. He was darkly amused by a customer who, referring to the name displayed on his apron, remarked, "I didn't know you guys had names." Mr. Hoffman helped to organize his store in Chicago, one of more than 600 that would unionize beginning in 2021, after years of perceived indignities. "If you're going to be disrespected like this," he told me, "you have to have a bigger piece of the pie." Thus, the vanishing diploma divide. Since President Trump's first term, and especially since his re-election, political analysts have pointed to the gap between college-educated voters and those without degrees as one of the most significant fissures in American politics. In 2024, Mr. Trump won non-college voters by almost 15 points, while losing the college-educated by a similar margin. By contrast, non-union voters had narrowly backed a Democrat, Mr. Obama, as recently as 2012. To explain the growing divide, commentators typically emphasize how the college-educated are more liberal on social and cultural issues than are those without degrees, and how those issues have played a larger role in deciding elections over the past generation. But that analysis tells us only half the story of how American politics has shifted. Critically, it misses how the views of college-educated voters on economic questions have come to resemble those of voters without degrees. A 2023 paper by the political scientist William Marble found that college graduates were well to the right of voters without a degree on economic issues during the 1980s and 1990s, but they began drifting leftward around 2004, and by 2020, college graduates were somewhat to the left of non-graduates on these issues. More strikingly, the entire outlook of college graduates appears to have changed. During the Reagan and Clinton eras, many college-educated workers saw themselves as management adjacent, as future executives and aspiring professionals being groomed for a life of affluence. They did not believe they had much in common with the working class. In the late 1990s, only slightly more than half supported labor unions, according to Gallup. But by this decade, college graduates often identified more with rank-and-file workers than with employers. According to Gallup, about three-quarters of college graduates supported auto workers and Hollywood writers in standoffs with their employers in 2023, when both groups went on strike. That matches their support for labor unions overall. Matt Hoffman, one of the doctors who recently unionized in Minnesota, and no relation to Teddy Hoffman, told me that he took his children to a United Automobile Workers picket line in 2023. "In our society, the sides are workers versus management," he said. "I wanted them to understand that." In a high-wattage presidential election, when the country was primarily focused on cultural issues, college graduates and those without a degree often appeared to have little in common. But when it came down to how they felt about their bosses or their bank accounts, it was suddenly harder to tell them apart. They were no longer on opposite teams. but how this will all play out is still up in the air. But Mr. Hoffman's store in Chicago may offer an early clue here. The staff was a mix of college graduates, college students, and employees who did not aspire to a four-year degree. One employee earned a welding certificate while at Starbucks and later became an apprentice pipe fitter. But regardless of their educational backgrounds, they almost all voted to unionize the store in 2022. The final tally was 20-3. Next, I would like to read for you an article which appeared in the Wall Street Journal on the 6th of January. The title of this is Dealing with Bosses Who Think They Are the Smartest: Strategies You Can Try to Get Your Points Across with Leaders Who Always Know the Best. Leaders who think they are the smartest people in the room usually reject others' viewpoints and ideas out of hand. This article was compiled for the Wall Street Journal by Susan Lucia Annunzio. Have you ever worked for or with a leader who truly believed they were the smartest person in the room? These people are often charismatic and dynamic, true, able to draw people in with their passion and their energy. But they also assume anyone who disagrees with them is incompetent, delusional, or even a saboteur, so they can reject their opinions and ideas out of hand. They may ask for others' input and give lip service to their ideas, but it quickly becomes clear that it's my way or the highway. This type of behavior has long-term consequences. It prompts other team members to drop out of the discussion altogether or withhold information, fearing that they will be belittled if they speak up. As a result, better ideas never do see the light of day. Product defects are covered up. Unethical practices continue unchecked, and deals often are thwarted. If your boss acts like the smartest guy and you aren't ready to quit your job, there are some actions you can take to benefit both you and the company. None of these are guaranteed, of course, to work, but they will give you a fighting chance. First, avoid power struggles. Don't be afraid to express your opinions, but avoid engaging in power struggles with the boss. You may think that if you present facts and data to support your viewpoint, you possibly can convince the smartest person that you may be right and they wrong. But in a power struggle, the boss always wins. Even if your boss discusses your viewpoint or idea, it may spark something positive. One executive client I worked with told me his boss always called his ideas stupid. He said, "At first I'd try to reason with her and explain my thinking. Eventually, I realized there was no point because often, 2 or 3 days later, she would return enthusiastically to tell me about her new idea, which was the very same one that I had suggested earlier." If you want to challenge your boss, try raising thoughtful, non-confrontational questions that illuminate risks or unintended consequences of a plan or decision. For example, if we do this, could it prevent us from reaching the revenue target because X, Y, and Z might happen? Or is it possible that this decision might unintentionally hurt morale? Approaching the conversation in this way might allow the smartest person in the room to conclude on his or her own that the plan could be improved. Don't push back on the boss by yourself. Before key discussions, connect with colleagues who may have more influence than you do and who recognize the leader's behavior as destructive. A coordinated effort where multiple voices express can present a viewpoint creates credibility and increases the odds of success. If the above suggestions are not successful, you may have to accept that there are some things you cannot change and you might need to find a new job. I have seen talented, brilliant executives whose confidence has been shaken by the continual rejection of their thoughts and ideas. Don't fall into that trap. Instead, take what you can from the experience and quietly prepare for what's next. First, give priority to your physical and mental health, especially if you are experiencing high levels of stress. Eat well, get enough sleep, and make time to exercise or practice meditation. Do your job well, but don't do more. Give up on getting credit and focus your efforts on executing the boss's ideas, which in some cases might actually be your own. When your organization enjoys success because of your efforts, celebrate it, even if the smartest person insists on taking the bow. And remember, even the toughest boss can be a teacher. Sometimes we learn more about what not to do than what to do. You know what it feels like to be ignored, undervalued, and disrespected, which will help you to avoid treating people that way when you are in the position of authority. Bosses are invested with legitimate power, but no single person has all the answers. The leaders who think that they do are sorely mistaken. Susan Lucia Annunzio, who wrote this article, is a leadership coach, author, and president and CEO of the Center for High Performance. She also is an associate adjunct professor of management at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. This does bring us to the end of the time that we have for our program on careers for today. I hope that you've enjoyed listening in and will enjoy the rest of your day and stay well. Thank you for listening in. I'm Irene Lubin and I'm a volunteer reader. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.